I'm very happy now to welcome Wenda Trevathan. She is a professor of biological anthropology at New Mexico State University. She's author of the book Ancient Bodies, Modern Lives, How Evolution Has Shaped Women's Health. And she will be speaking tonight at 6:30 at the New Mexico History Museum, giving a talk called Evolution and Women's Lives. It's sponsored by the School for Advanced Research. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Coincidentally, right after this was set up, I read the article that you wrote in New Mexico Magazine. So
right.
I had some knowledge about what this program was all about before I even came up here to Santa Fe to visit with you.
Excellent. Yeah, dear listeners, this month's New Mexico Magazine has an article by yours truly, if you care to pick up a copy of it. So let's talk about your work, evolutionary anthropology, biological anthropology, looking at human health and women's health specifically through the lens of evolution is a really different way than looking at health in a sort of mechanistic way, like your body as a car where you can change out parts and things like that.
Right. I think one of the major differences is that we're looking usually at the species as a whole. We're not usually looking at an individual woman who might have a specific problem that needs to be treated. We're looking at the species as a whole, and a lot of the things that medicine thinks are problems in women's health and in health in general turn out to actually, in most cases, not be a problem. It's just the result of an evolutionary process, and since there are 7 billion of us around, that obviously that evolutionary process has been pretty successful. And a lot of things, when we actually do try to treat them kind of mechanistically, as you said, by correcting something, we sometimes cause more problems than we solve. Particularly when you think about, for example, obstetrics. The human body, by definition, is a series of compromises. The evolutionary view is that it was not designed by an individual creator, in the case of Western
a supernatural
thought. Supernatural being who actually created this perfect creature that was designed to do all these different kinds of things. And I don't think medical specialists usually think of it that way, but they often treat the body that way, as if it was designed to do a particular thing. And our body, because of the evolutionary process, working with what it has. Stephen Joe Gould, an evolutionary biologist who did a lot of writing when he was alive, talked about evolution as a contingent process, that every step along the way depended on what had gone on before.
Right.
And if anything had been different a million years ago, we might not even be here, for example. And in the case of the body as it was, as it evolved, we have a situation with with women, for example, where we've got a body that works pretty well as walking along on two legs, and it works pretty well giving birth to babies, but it would be great if we could design it so that the hips were wider so that the baby would have an easier time coming out, because most people have a challenge when they're giving birth. They find it somewhat painful. They find it, you know, takes a long time to happen. And if you were to design it, you would perhaps make it a little bit wider so that the baby could come out more easily, or you'd make the baby a little bit smaller or something like that. But that's not the kind of thing that we're stuck with. If you think about it from an evolutionary perspective, we have to work with what we've got, and we actually do a pretty good job in most cases, unless there's a lot of intervention, and sometimes there's too much intervention.
What's an example of something that we might consider a problem, but evolutionary biology looks at it as just a phenomenon that we evolved with?
Yeah, well, one example, in the language of evolutionary medicine, sometimes we talk about, I don't know if we've mentioned the word evolutionary medicine, but that's sort of the perspective that I'm coming from, where we're using evolutionary principles, research and information from evolutionary theory to understand health problems and health issues, not necessarily problems, but contemporary health issues. And a classic example that it doesn't really have that much to do with women's health, but it is an example, is an elevated body temperature in response to a viral infection, particularly in response to a viral infection, which we know we don't have very many tools, medical tools, for fighting a virus. Our antibiotics don't work on viruses, so the only thing we can do is kind of wait and do treat some of the symptoms and help the body along in the healing process. But the elevation of body temperature in response to a viral infection is the body doing what it just the right thing in order to repel that virus, because by elevating the body temperature, a lot of viruses can't live in a higher. A lot of viruses, for example, if you take human body temperature as an example, a lot of viruses can't live in a temperature of 101 or something like that. We treat it as a problem and quickly take aspirin or do something like that to lower that temperature, and that actually sometimes enables the virus to continue to replicate. Obviously, if it gets to be 103, 104, you have gone into the realm of a medical problem that does need treatment. You don't want to let a child in particular have a very, very high elevated body temperature. But we see that as a defense mechanism, the body defense mechanism. Evolutionary medicine sees that as a defense mechanism up to a point at which it then becomes a defect. So the idea is it a defense or is it a defect? Up to a point, it's a defense. Beyond that point, then it becomes something that probably warrants medical treatment.
So in evolutionary medicine, is there kind of a general principle underlying it that says treat as little as possible because the body evolved to know what it's doing?
Probably, but that's probably taking an extreme. One phrase that's often used is that evolutionary medicine would recommend a wait-and-see attitude for a lot of health apparent what seem to be health problems.
Not cancer.
But probably not. No, clearly. That I don't think anybody's got an evolutionary view on cancer, except there are controversies about what causes cancer. There's some that think that infectious agents are at the base of that. So if there's some way to treat infectious agents early on, then the downstream effects of cancer might not be manifested. But sure, there are definitely true pathologies, true defects that, thankfully, modern medicine can usually deal with. And in the example of an elevated fever, elevated body temperature, 105 in a 3-year-old child is potentially fatal. And thankfully, we can treat that. We have mechanisms for treating that. And treating it is the right thing to do if you want to talk about it from a right and wrong perspective. But in some levels that remain in the realm of healthfulness, the broader definition of healthfulness, probably the wait and see. So wait and see is an attitude that a lot of people would recommend in evolutionary medicine, although evolutionary medicine is not really making recommendations. They're suggesting ways of viewing these things.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like you can go to an evolutionary doctor.
Exactly. If I got sick, I would not go to an evolutionary theorist in most cases. I would go to a modern medical practitioner.
And I think you also suggest in your book that an approach in, you know, the getting rid of the mechanistic approach entirely is not necessarily the right thing. I mean,
not. You
set bones, you
sure,
know, it's
sure.
like a carpenter, you know.
Right. You don't want to say, oh, well, that's just what happened. The bone broke and the evolutionary
right.
process has not resulted in completely unbreakable titanium bones, and it broke. And it, you know, knees go out. We wouldn't live in such a good state of health as long as we do without medicine. I don't have any denial about that.
Well, and knees go out because we're bipedal, and bipedalism is something that you write about a lot in the book, and it's part of our evolutionary reality that sets us apart from other primates and so on.
Yes, exactly. And it's one of those examples, one of the other phrases that we often use when we talk about evolution in general and evolutionary medicine is the idea of trade-offs, that there are compromises. We are a bundle of compromises. Every body is a bundle of compromises, human, chicken, whatever. It's not, again, we don't think it was designed. The chicken was designed to look and be exactly like it is, or that the human body, your body, my body, were designed to be exactly like they are. We think they're the result of an evolutionary process which has a lot of compromises and a lot of things that sometimes don't work.
So the compromise, what does the compromise look like in terms of, for example, the human knees?
The human knees. The human knee is obviously evolved, well, in our perspective, evolved from a quadrupedal knee, where the weight of the body is evenly distributed along four legs, for example, and along a vertical, horizontal vertebral column. So there's not as much weight on the knees of a four-legged animal. So you start with a four-legged animal that then evolved over a long period of time into a two-legged animal, and transferring all that weight of the body onto that knee that wasn't designed to be a bipedal knee. It was originally designed to be a four-legged knee. And the result is that we have knees that are pretty good, that work most of the time and serve us well most of the time, but they can be taken to extremes and, you know, too much running or dietary kinds of things. Maybe someone decides to start running and exercising when they're 45 years old and they've never exercised before, and they put some stresses on those knees that then result in real problems.
But in terms of evolution, the compromise is you lose, your knees are stressed by having the extra weight on them right. from standing upright, but what you gain, the compromise, is having a big brain.
By standing up, well, the standing up came early in human evolutionary history. We think it probably emerged between 5 and 7 million years ago. I mean, it's the hallmark of being human, is bipedalism, walking on two legs. The brain came a lot later, 2, 2.5 million years ago. So the truth is that we don't know exactly what the advantage is. When you try to imagine that early transition, whatever it looked like, sort of a half biped, half two-legged animal, you can't, you know, it sounds like, again, too many compromises to really make it efficient. But people who've done some extensive studies have shown that walking on two legs, not necessarily running, although Dan Lieberman, who will be here in the spring, will tell you a whole lot more about that. He's at one of the SAR lecturers in the spring. Not necessarily for running, but that we're very good at walking over great distances. And it's energetically expensive. When it comes down to it, evolution really is about the use of resources, use of food resources. So you, if you expend a great deal of energy to rush across the plain to capture an animal, you're going to need more energy to be able to keep doing that. So in the case of bipedalism, it is seen by, and this is based on experimental work as well, as a very energetically efficient way of moving across open territory.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. It's much more energetic.
One would think, you know,
exactly.
that tigers would have a much easier time.
Right. Not walking. Persistence hunting is probably what humans originally gained from walking on two legs.
Very interesting.
Walking, and essentially walking prey to death. I mean, if you're walking, I mean, a human has, we have nothing. We have these little fingernails. We have no big teeth. We can't really do anything without sophisticated tools, and we don't think sophisticated tools were part of that early process. But you could come upon an animal and walk and walk and walk and walk and never allow it to stop to eat, never allow it to stop to drink, and pretty soon it's just going to collapse. And humans can walk for days and days and days. So we think the trade-off actually at the beginning was probably energy conservation.
We're talking to Wenda Trevathan about her book, Ancient Bodies, Modern Lives, How Evolution Has Shaped Women's Health. We're back with Wenda Trevathan. Now, we live very different lives than we did 250,000 years ago, 2 million years ago, when we were hominids, bipedal creatures walking around, living in bands and so on. And our bodies, in some ways, have adapted to these huge changes, and yet we're the same bodies in many ways that we were then. In what ways have we been able to adapt, and in what ways is it hard for us to adapt to the life that we've created for ourselves?
Well, in fact, that's the source of the title of my book, Ancient Bodies, Modern Lives, that we have bodies that are the result of umpteen million, 250,000, 10,000, wherever you want to start the clock, years of biological evolutionary processes. And the kinds of lives that we live today are so different, and I'm talking about the lives you and I live, are so different from the lives of our ancestors, and so different from the lives that our bodies evolved to yeah. adapt to, if you will.
We're not out walking antelopes.
We're not walking down antelopes. We're sitting here in this coffee shop, and we could easily order 1,000 calories worth of food and sit here and eat it without working at all. I mean, we're all working for money and that kind of thing, but I mean working in terms of energy expenditure. And that's resulted in some problems. I mean, all of us know that most of us struggle with weight issues, for example, eating that 2,000-calorie meal and then feeling sluggish and wanting to go lie down and watching too much TV and so on. And that's not what our bodies evolved for. And so we have a lot of health compromises that result from that. And by we, I mean mostly people that live like the lives that we're familiar with in Santa Fe and in New Mexico and the United States and so on, because there are still people in some parts of the world that are working really hard physically every day, and they're not consuming a great deal of calories, and getting calories, getting food is still a lot of work. So we can't just say that the species itself is living a totally different life, but the vast majority of us are living very different lives from what our biology evolved for. And the pace of evolution, of cultural evolutionary change, which is what we're really talking about now, has vastly outstripped the pace of biological evolutionary change, compromising our ability to keep up. And we do have some problems that result from that, some of which are the cancers that you were mentioning a minute ago. And in my perspective, looking at women's health, I'm looking particularly at reproductive cancers. What evolution really is all about is having babies.
Right.
And I say this as a person who has not had babies, so I'm not sitting here trying to be, you know, say this is the only reason women were ever created or anything or appeared on the planet or anything like that. But evolution, the evolutionary process has shaped the ability to have babies. And so one of the things that, going back to the eating the whole 2,000-calorie meal or something like that, one of the results of that is that we are really good at storing calories for to use for other things, for use for growth, to use for healing, to use for ovulating, to use for breastfeeding, to use for gathering food for our babies, our children, and so on. And yet many of us don't reproduce. I mean, you and I are examples of people who have evolved bodies for reproduction, but we haven't actually reproduced. And that is referred to, again, in the language of evolutionary medicine as a mismatch. Our evolved bodies are in many ways mismatched with our contemporary lives.
Except in the sense that we are overpopulating the planet. And
exactly.
I don't know whether it's an instinctive thing that so many of us don't want to have children or want to have very few, that we sense the whole.
Well, there have been arguments about that. It's in evolution, it's referred to as group selection, where the argument is that there's a process by which those many individuals, and I think the most of the studies were done on flocks of blackbirds or something like that, but individuals sensed that population was outstripping resources, for example, and refrained from reproducing.
Which is what our cells do, if they're healthy cells. When you get a cut and you need more cells, your body produces more cells, and when you're healed, the process slows back down again.
Yeah, and I guess to some extent there are some parallels in the evolutionary evolution of life and the evolution of our individual cells in the body, but I'm not sure that it works in that particular case. Because think about it this way. If you had this flock of blackbirds, and you know, half of them decide not to reproduce because their resources are being, the population's outstripping resources, and half of them decide to reproduce and go ahead and do it anyway, who's there in the next generation? It's the ones who decided to reproduce, not the ones who decided not to reproduce. So that drive, if you will, to continue reproducing will always win out if you think about the evolutionary process as a game, and some people do use that as a metaphor. Will always win out. Those who reproduce will always win out over those who don't reproduce.
There's another piece of it, which is that women throughout the history of evolution have spent most of their lives pregnant or lactating, and many of us now are spending most of our lives having menstrual cycles and not conceiving. And what is the effect of that on our health? What is the effect of being pregnant and lactating all the time versus not?
Well, I think that's a very important question. And that really is the gist of what I argue in the book, Ancient Bodies, Modern Lives, because I'm talking about women's health in this case. And what our bodies have evolved to do is to be very good at reproducing and to be able to reproduce under all kinds of circumstances. I mean, we've seen pictures of people, women who looked like they were starving, but they were still having babies. So our bodies are really good at doing that. What women in the past did, we think, and this is not something we can directly assess, although we can look at contemporary populations that are living, people living today that are living lives similar to what we think our ancestors were living. We see that they reach menarche, they reach puberty when they're about 16, 17 years of age. Usually the first several cycles are not ovulatory, and we know that from contemporary populations as well. And then they usually get pregnant pretty soon after that, maybe 19 or something like that. They are pregnant, and they're not cycling when they're pregnant, of course. They nurse their babies. They breastfeed their babies probably for two and a half years, up to 3 years. They're not, because of the way they're breastfeeding their babies, which is pretty much constant, not literally constantly like a kangaroo, but constantly in the sense of the baby's always with the mother nursing. No menstrual cycles during that period. She starts cycling again, she starts ovulating again, she pretty soon gets pregnant. So they're estimating that the total number of menstrual cycles that a woman in the past had was somewhere between 60 and 100. People like you and me who've never had children have had probably 400 to 450 menstrual cycles. We start our cycles usually when we're 12, 13, 14 years of age, and we cycle pretty much uninterruptedly 13 times a year until we're about 50 years of age. So that adds up to about 450 cycles. I would argue, and many people agree with me, that our bodies did not evolve to have that many ups and downs of the cycle.
And what's the downside of having all those ups and downs?
Well, think about what happens in each menstrual cycle. All these new cells, you were talking about these new cells a minute ago, all these new cells are made. New cells in the breast to get ready for ovulation, because the body doesn't, quote, know that it's not going to get pregnant. It's getting ready to get pregnant. New cells in the breast, lots of new cells being made. New cells in the endometrium, lots of new cells in the uterus. All these cells are being created, if you will, to prepare the body for pregnancy. Doesn't happen, they drop off. Doesn't happen because either there's not the sexual activity, or because of birth control pills or something like that, other ways of controlling birth, drops off. So you have constant cell turnover rates every month from age 13 until about age 50, and also very, very high levels, these constant rises in estrogen and progesterone, and getting the female, quote, female reproductive hormones getting ready for pregnancy and then dropping off, getting ready for pregnancy, dropping off. So you have all these up to 450 cycles of cell turnovers and surges of estrogen and progesterone that probably, we would argue, can help explain why we have such high rates of reproductive cancers, breast cancer, endometrial cancer, and ovarian cancer in our population.
We're talking to Wenda Trevathan about her book, Ancient Bodies, Modern Lives, How Evolution Has Shaped Women's Health. When a woman does get pregnant, and it turns out that actually getting pregnant and keeping the pregnancy is a little harder than we might think, even though we are built for that, mm-hmm. and that's what evolution is all about. Then when we do, we go into this evolutionary process of reproduction and all the body changes, and then birth itself. And I think it's interesting to talk about for a moment what the health effects of birth are on both the mother and child.
Well, that's an area that I've gotten really interested in lately, because we're seeing such a dramatic rise in cesarean section in different parts of the world. I mean, in some places like Brazil, in some hospitals, 70% and 80% of women are giving birth by cesarean section. And that's a place where medical intervention certainly has been very important, save millions of lives or hundreds of thousands of lives of mothers and babies. But the assumption is that if you can just get that baby born and make it easy on the mother, let her go to sleep or whatever and not be aware of it or deaden the pain or whatever and remove the baby surgically, and it's a healthy baby, then that's fine. You've got a healthy mom, you've got a healthy baby. That's assuming that there's nothing beneficial about the process of labor and delivery. And it turns out that there are a lot of beneficial factors associated with that. Clearly, if a woman or a baby are going to die because of the birth process, then a cesarean section is absolutely wonderful that you can have a baby through that. But if there aren't really any medical reasons for it, the gains for the baby, for example, labor, the whole process of labor, that squeezing of the contractions and so on, stimulate respiration in the baby. So babies who are born naturally vaginally tend to have a much easier time adjusting to life after birth. They're breathing better. Their gastrointestinal function is better. And we're now thinking that there may be what are referred to as epigenetic benefits to that, that there are genes that are triggered during the birth process, by the birth process, that then have an impact on later life, health in later life. And the specifics of that are still being worked out, but there is pretty good evidence that missing birth probably has some negative consequences on the infant. In the case of the mother, obviously if she's terribly traumatized by birth, that's not a particularly good thing to do. But what I've argued is that women who are otherwise physically capable of giving birth, if they have emotional support at that time from birth attendants, from their partners, if that's what they choose, from what we now, the profession we're familiar with now, the doula, the person who's there to help as a labor coach and as a birth coach in that, that when they have that medical, that emotional assistance, that they're actually adjust better to motherhood, and their breastfeeding rates are much higher, they're more comfortable with their status even after first-time babies. So there seems to be a lot of positive emotional benefits to the actual birth process when that is an option.
Breastfeeding is also very important for both women's and children's
right.
health.
In fact, there's so much evidence that breast is best, if you will, that it's hard for me to imagine the process of deciding against breastfeeding. I know that there are women who really have some real struggles with that, so I'm not denying that in any way. But the whole gain from breast milk for the infant in particular, from immunological function and so on, breastfed babies just overwhelmingly adjust better to later life, have better health, apparently even have better cognitive skills and a number of other things. So when I did the research for this book looking at all the advantages of breastfeeding, it was very difficult for me to come up with any reasons why anybody should be encouraged to avoid breastfeeding. Again, we know there are compromises, but
there's a lot of things that, I mean, those are examples that you were talking about right now that traditional societies know and have always known, and that we are having to relearn and sort of pat ourselves on the back for coming up with this great new discovery that every Inca mother has known for thousands of years.
I think in the traditional societies, as you're referring to them, I mean, everybody breastfeeds. It's not even a decision, if you will. It's not even anything anybody talks about. They breastfeed. So every young girl grows up with breastfeeding women all around her, and she doesn't have any concern about, I mean, I can't get into the minds of these people, but there doesn't seem to be much of an issue about, am I going to have any trouble with this, and how's this going to work, and is my baby going to get enough food or something like that. In other words, there are lots and lots of role models, and we don't have a lot of role models. We do now, of course, because it is increasing in number of people that are deciding to breastfeed. But a lot of women really struggle with not understanding how to make that happen, and it's one of those things that thinking about and making it happen were probably not part of our ancestral past. It was probably pretty easy to fall into that.
Are there other examples that evolutionary medicine looks at, is looking at traditional societies to say, this is sort of best practices?
I think so. I mean, anthropologists long before evolutionary medicine came on the scene, anthropologists were looking at practices in a lot of other cultures that looked like they'd be very beneficial for us. I think another one that's been very controversial is the idea of co-sleeping, because there are huge concerns about co-sleeping, about mothers and infants sleeping together in this country. And in fact, it's actually, I don't know what it's actually illegal in a lot of places, but it's so strongly recommended against. And yet, everybody in traditional societies, mothers and babies sleep together all the time. Because for one, they're breastfeeding through the night, so their babies are right next to them through the night. So that's a modern practice that, given the context of the sleeping environment that we're in, with big fluffy duvets and fluffy pillows and fluffy beds and maybe people who drink before they go to bed or something like that, there are probably some real problems with that. But co-sleeping is something that's been part of our evolutionary heritage. And to say that it's absolutely unhealthy is taking things a little bit too far. It's perhaps unhealthy in certain circumstances.
What, the circumstances in which you roll over and crush your...
The idea would be, I mean, most of the people who have looked...
Does that ever happen?
It happens if you're drunk, if you're on drugs, if you're obese. There are suggestions of that, but
normally
there's almost no evidence of that.
Very,
it's a very, very controversial issue, because nothing's worse than having a baby die of SIDS or something like that. So it's a tough one for evolutionary medicine to tackle, but still the perspective we get from traditional societies is that it's a healthful practice.
Let's talk for a moment about old age. I mean, we're built for reproduction. Then at the age of 40 or 50 something, we stop reproducing. We stop having the ability to reproduce, and yet there is an evolutionary advantage to older women in society.
Absolutely. And I think that's important. A lot of people say, well, gosh, if evolution is all about reproduction, why on earth does it stop? Why didn't natural selection favor women to continue reproducing as they got older? And there are a couple of answers to that. One is, a lot of people will say, well, they didn't start getting older until recently. You know, it's modern medicine that's kept us alive to this point in our lives. And that's not really true. In traditional societies, there are plenty of people in their 60s. When we're talking about people, healthy people in their 80s and 90s, as we see all around us in Santa Fe, that probably has a lot to do with lifestyle and modern medicine and so on. But there were plenty of postmenopausal women in the past and in traditional societies, and probably have been around for a long, long time as well. And I think one reason for that is selection at some level has favored those older women who live many years beyond reproduction because they're contributing to childcare. Our babies are extremely expensive and difficult to raise. It's very, very hard for one woman all by herself to raise a human baby.
And when you say expensive, you're talking about energy expenditure.
Well, both. I mean, I think we know from Americans, but yeah. I am talking about energy and time and energy And anyone who's raised a child knows that they're not really independent and on their own until they're in their late teens. Even in traditional societies, they're still dependent on their mothers and their families until they're in their early, certainly mid-teens. And having some assistance, what that means, if the mother, if the grandmother's there to help take care of the baby when the baby is weaned, and a toddler is still not independent by any means, even though it's weaned, it might not be, it's not independent. If she's there to take care of that baby and help relieve some of the burden, the mother can start ovulating again and she can reproduce. So the grandmother is directly contributing to the reproductive success of her daughter and therefore her own reproductive success.
Do older men have analogous role in society from an evolutionary medical perspective?
They do, usually not in direct childcare, but in providing resources, yes. Because older men, as long as they're healthy, they're still out hunting and things like that. But of course, they don't cease reproducing. They don't have menopause. They are capable of contributing sperm and having new babies all along. And they do that right on up until the end. But direct childcare on the part of men, it's not completely lacking. It is not as common as maternal, as grandmother childcare, though.
There is a great deal more to talk about, but we are running out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe. Wenda Trevathan is professor of biological anthropology at New Mexico State University. She's author of the book Ancient Bodies, Modern Lives, How Evolution Has Shaped Women's Health. And she will be speaking tonight at 6:30 at the New Mexico History Museum. The lecture is called Evolution and Women's Lives. And it's sponsored by the School for Advanced Research. For more information, you can go to that website at sarweb.org. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.